From the Mutual Broadcasting System, this is STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk. Now, retired Marine Intelligence Officer and globally recognized risk expert, Hal Kempfer.
Well, welcome to STRAT, Strategic Risk Assessment Talk, and today, I hope this generates controversy. And frankly, it should be boring because I'm going to talk about the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, which, frankly, prior to what's happened in the last few months, nobody really knew anything about. The Marines who call ourselves a few, the proud. Well, let me just put it this way. If you work civil military stuff, support for civil authorities, military support for civil authorities, defense support for civil authorities. If you work that area within the Marine Corps, you were extremely few. I don't know about proud, but we were definitely a few, and there weren't many of us, and it's not a very well understood area. I have a kind of an odd background with this, and I'll just kind of show that before I dig into this a little bit. And we've got this big court decision that just came out in California, and I'm going to talk about that, talk about the act, talk about exceptions to the act. In the early 90s, I was at the Officers Club in Quantico, Virginia, contemplating my future, and an old friend showed up, somebody I'd served with in what is now called a light armored reconnaissance battalion. And this was after Desert Storm, and we started talking. It had been quite some time since I'd seen him. And he said that he was we're at the same rank, both captains at the time. And he said, hey, I'm working this thing with counter drug, and we're providing intelligence support for federal law enforcement, counter drug law enforcement. And that set me down a path where for years I worked with DEA, FBI, U.S. Customs, a plethora, which means a lot to me, of multi-jurisdictional task forces, multi-jurisdictional interagency intelligence activities, all focused on going after the drug cartels and those criminal organizations. And then years later, I got involved with things like chemical, biological, radiological, nuclear response issues tied to support in this area, defense support of civil authorities with terrorists, natural disasters, man-made events, whatever it was. And did that a lot in my career and interspersed it with normal, good old Marine Corps warfighting stuff. So this was kind of near and dear. And then once I retired, I moved on and I did this, taught this for the National Guard. I taught it for big Department of Defense. I have covered this all over. I've talked about it in the news. Anyway, let me just say that I was a bit of a Posse Comitatus nerd, okay? And it was just one of those things where not that many people really understood it. And they didn't even know where it came from. And I've talked about that before. It did come, not really any auspicious civil liberties concept. It actually came from 1878 during the Reconstruction of the former Confederate South. The only thing the federal government had was federal troops to go down there and enforce federal law. Needless to say, the white Southerners that just lost the Civil War weren't too keen on enforcing these laws that gave African Americans, the former slaves, the right to vote, land, do all this other stuff. And they were really, and there was also this thing called the Ku Klux Klan, which was engaged in essentially organized terror with lynchings and all sorts of stuff. And the only thing that could really stop them was federal troops. And Ulysses S. Grant was using federal troops extensively throughout the South to stop the KKK, to stop this sort of stuff from happening. However, he was fighting a political tide, which eventually he lost. And that's how this act got in there. So it wasn't any great civil liberties sort of thing, we got to stop the military from going in there and, trampling local authorities and, trampling our rights and stuff. It had nothing, absolutely nothing to do with that. What it had to do with was that you had a bunch of racist, just atrocious, horrible former Confederates that want to impose Jim Crow and everything that surrounds that era. And that's where this law came from. So it's the Posse Comitatus Act. So no great auspicious beginnings. All right, I'm going to get with that. All right, so let me give you a little backdrop. Everybody's afraid of this because they go, oh, no, the military is going to go rolling into our cities and we're going to have a third world type of military coup d'etat that stops civil authorities and ends democracy. And that's this kind of specter of what people see, you know, that the military will be eviscerating they'll have a president that uses the military to eviscerate his political enemies and all of this stuff. All right. And that has been one of the great fears. And certainly Hollywood has played on that theme many times in the past. So that's always a fear. However, there is a long history of the U.S. military actually engaging here in the homeland, if you will. We're doing a variety of different things. In the 1920s, they were, engaged with protecting the U.S. mail because the Federal Postal Service was being robbed all the time. So they actually used the Marines to protect the mail. So security missions like that, protection missions, stuff like that, not new. All right. There's been a lot of very charged political rhetoric that's been chasing this entire thing with the deployment of federalized National Guard and Marines in Los Angeles, and of course what's happened in D.C. and what could be happening in Chicago. And this obviously weighed very heavy with a federal judge, because this federal judge just ruled that the Trump administration had violated the Posse Comitatus Act. All right, I will say this going in: speech matters, and despite what I think the actions of the troops were, and I didn't see a violation of Posse Comitatus unless you take a very broad view, which this judge clearly did in his judgment. But speech matters. And if you're the Secretary of Defense, if you're the President of the United States and you say things, you are in the chain of command. And if you express intent in your speech, which looks like a violation of Posse Comitatus, that has weight because of where they are. They're not just some senator or something piping off, and saying something, as senators tend to do all the time. They are actually in the chain of command. So, and that weighed into this decision as well. But I don't think this thing is done by any stretch. All right, this is what the Posse Comitatus Act actually says. It's a really short piece of law. It says, this is 1878, whoever, except in cases under circumstances expressly authorized by the Constitution or Act of Congress, willfully uses any part of the Army, and later they added the Air Force because the Air Force didn't exist back in 1878, but the Army Air Corps was the nucleus of the Air Force, all right, as a posse comitatus, which means power of the county, which was a something that they were using, that the sheriffs would use the military as a posse to do law enforcement. All right. The union-appointed sheriffs in the South, or union-anointed sheriffs in the South, would use the union troops to actually do law enforcement functions or otherwise execute the laws, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 2 years or both. I know this because we were constantly told, look, if you violate this thing, you can go to the Hooskow for 2 years. That was a good way to get our attention, all right? And we were doing stuff with civil authorities. This was one of the rules that we had to go with, was don't violate the Posse Comitatus Act. Now, there are some exceptions. Title 18 U.S. Code, Section 831, provides that if nuclear material is involved in an emergency, the Secretary of Defense may provide assistance to the Department of Justice, notwithstanding the Posse Comitatus Act. But another way of saying, if it's a nuke involved, all rules are off. The military can come in and do that. And that's very important because there is no state or local law enforcement entity that knows how to work with the threat of nuclear or radiological weapons. I mean, look, I know some folks that know a lot about radiological stuff and know a lot about nuclear stuff. There are state and local law enforcement or state or local employees, but not like the Department of Defense, and certainly not like the Department of Energy. So there was an exception made for that. Then also 10 U.S. Code, Title 10 U.S. Code, Chapter 18. Title 10 is federal troops, federalized troops are under Title 10, authorizes military support for civilian law enforcement agencies for counter-drug operations and in emergencies involving chemical or biological weapons of mass destruction. My background, that's exactly what I worked. Both all those things you just heard, I did that extensively, all right? Let me get back to this. The Secretary of Defense may provide information allow the use of military equipment facilities, train law enforcement officials in the operation and maintenance of military equipment, and maintain such equipment. Support for law enforcement agencies may not impair military readiness. Military personnel shall not participate in searches, seizures, arrests, or similar activities unless such participation is otherwise authorized by law. Exception: military police personnel, for example, may enforce the law within their jurisdictions, like a military base. All right. So it doesn't encompass everywhere. If it's federal property like that, they can use that. And I can tell you that we looked at this many times, that if we have federal troops on federal property, there are certain things that they can do. And I can tell you that after Posse Comitatus was passed, that there were federal troops that were the first park rangers at Yosemite. All right. The first national park. And so it is not unusual, but that was federal property, and it was a federal park, federal parkland, if you will. And so they used federal troops for that. And so there's been a lot of interpretations over the many years, but this has happened. All right. Now, Posse Comitatus Act, you may have noticed, did not specifically name the Navy and Marines. All right. Frankly, I think at that time that it wasn't an issue. Nobody thought of the Marines or the Navy. Your Marines were pretty small back then. You know, the Navy wasn't doing anything in the former Confederate states to speak of. So it just, you know, it didn't explicitly mention it, just said the Army, and then later include the Air Forces that came out of the Army Air Corps, you know, after World War II, became the Air Force. Anyway, in December of 2021, all branches, probably everybody missed this, including the Navy and Marine Corps, were formally included under the Posse Comitatus Act as an amendment. So this is not a dead piece of this is not arcane legislation. This is not a dead piece of law. This actually was something that was amended as recently as the end of 2021, which is not that long ago. All right. However, I will say this, and this is how I worked. Prior to that amendment, the Navy and Marine Corps were subject to similar restrictions through the Department of Defense. They had directives, other administrative measures. It was very clear to us that even though we weren't specifically mentioned in that act, that we were under the same rules. And that was a Secretary of Defense thing, and that was kind of drilled into us every time we went out there and did something. Now, there's an exception to Posse Comitatus called the Insurrection Act. And this really goes back. This is the Insurrection Act of 1807. Gosh, it seems like just yesterday when I saw this passed. Anyway, and this is what it says: in all cases of insurrection or obstruction to the laws either of the United States or of any individual state or territory, where it is lawful for the President of the United States to call forth the militia for the purpose of suppressing such insurrection, and that gives you an idea of the time period that they use the term militia, all right, or of causing the laws to be duly executed, it shall be lawful for him, meaning the President, to employ for the same purposes such part of the land or naval forces of the United States as shall be judged necessary, having first observed all the prerequisites of the law in that respect. And this is the Insurrection Act of 1807. So in the cases where you see obstruction of the laws, either of the United States or individual states or territory, and that's really interesting. So if the states are obstructing enforcement of immigration laws by federal law enforcement personnel, kind of makes you think, doesn't it? Yeah, I'm not advocating one thing or another. I'm just pointing it out. That's the way the act is written. All right. I'm sure that's the way that lawyers back in Washington, D.C. have seen it. Now, you're probably saying, well, yeah, but when is the last time how often do they do that? U.S. history, 30 times we have imposed the Insurrection Act. Notable instances such as some rather, I think, noble things like desegregation of schools. And then, of course, other things like responses to civil unrest. I'll give you some. Douglas MacArthur in 1832, you know, when World War I veterans marched, the Bonus Army, as they called it, were marching on Washington, D.C. The Insurrection Act, because they wanted their World War I bonuses. This is July of 1932. This is the midst of the Great Depression. They wanted that money now. And Douglas MacArthur led the army, and it was felt at the time that he actually violated Posse Comitatus. However, the Insurrection Act had been imposed. In 1943, there was a race riot in Detroit, and Franklin D. Roosevelt impose the Insurrection Act, and the riot was suppressed. In 1957, the Arkansas National Guard was blocking African-American students from a school in Little Rock. Dwight Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, federalized the Guard in order them to stand down, and federal troops escorted those students to school. John F. Kennedy used it multiple times. In September 62, there was a siege and riot of the University of Mississippi due to racial integration, and he suppressed a riot using federal troops. In June of 1963, the governor of Alabama, again, blocking integration of a school, racial integration. Alabama National Guard was federalized in order to stand down. All right. September, this was, 1963. This is right before he was assassinated. Alabama National Guard students, was blocking African-American students from an all-white school. He federalized the Guard, ordered them to stand down. Lyndon Johnson did the same thing in Alabama to protect civil rights marchers. Did the same thing. He imposed the Insurrection Act to deal with protests and riots in Detroit in 67. He did the same thing to suppress riots after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Ronald Reagan used it to use military personnel to stop a riot in Atlanta over the announced deportation of Cuban detainees. In 1989, George W. Bush used it in the Virgin Islands after Hurricane Hugo to restore order. And then, very famously, in 1992, Rodney King riots, that was also another instance. So what you see is there is a long history of the Insurrection Act. So this, is not a dead piece of law or arcane legislation. I will say this, that President Trump has not invoked the Insurrection Act. Maybe I should say has not invoked it yet, but there is precedence for having done so. And you get an idea that it doesn't have to be a massive insurrection. It can be a very localized thing. But I kind of bring that up because I read the act to you, and the language of the act is the language of the act. Now, let's talk about Judge Charles Breyer, okay? He ruled that President Trump violated the Posse Comitatus Act by deploying military troops to Los Angeles for law enforcement purposes. He found that the use of the California National Guard that were federalized U.S. Marines for civilian law enforcement duties constitute a violation of the law. And actually, that is correct. If you were to federalize without the Insurrection Act being imposed, if you used federalized National Guard and U.S. Marines for civilian law enforcement duties, that would be a violation of the act, all right, which prohibits federal military forces from engaging in such activities unless expressly authorized by Constitution or Congress, all right? That is, there's nothing wrong with what he said there. His ruling blocked the remaining National Guard troops, policing activities, and emphasized the separation of powers from the U.S. government. That was absolutely correct as well. Now, he is a U.S. District Court judge for the Northern District of California. His ruling is one judge's ruling, and he had been overturned by the Ninth Circuit before on this very issue, when he tried to block the deployment of those troops. And he has a rather interesting way of looking at it. Now, what does this mean? Well, if you take this ruling as it is, then the president would have a tough time using federalized National Guard troops or any federal troops in Chicago for what he's kind of indicated that he might do there. All right. Now, what has happened in Washington, D.C., despite all the protests early on about use of federal troops and everything, what's happened in D.C. is basically crime has dropped immensely. I think it's down like 90% or something like that. The president says it's down 100%, but I don't think that's correct. But it is down a lot. I don't think they've had any homicides, which is really exceptional for like 2 weeks or something in Washington, D.C., especially in summertime. And so it's, if you take a look at what he's done, but D.C. is different. Washington, D.C., District of Columbia. It is a federal district. They don't have a governor. They don't have a sovereign state as defined in the 10th Amendment with sovereign state responsibilities or rights. And so it's a different thing. It's a federal district, and the president kind of holds the role of the governor in that district. The National Guard there is always in a federalized status because there's no state status to be in. So it's a very different sort of thing. Now, Breyer's ruling cited statements by President Trump, Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. My take on some of the political rhetoric that I heard President Trump say, that I've heard Secretary of Defense Hegseth says, they would talk about how the troops went to L.A. and, you know, in so many words, suppress the rioting or the protests or whatever it is and restore order and things. And frankly, rhetorically speaking, what they were saying could be interpreted as command intent for what was doing. Now, the orders that the troops were under didn't reflect what was being said verbally by the Secretary of Defense nor the President. But nonetheless, they did say that, and they are the Secretary of Defense and the Commander-in-Chief. So there is something to be said about that. And there is certainly a responsibility of those in the chain of command, particularly at the most senior levels, to be careful about what they say. You know, politically, it may play very well to say some of these things, but it does, words have meaning. And so they need to be a little careful about that. Breyer's ruling also cited training by U.S. Army North, which is also called Fifth Army. I've worked extensively with them. I've worked with their joint task force command centers and stuff on major exercises and stuff. And so I'm very familiar with who they are and what they do. And I've also worked for what's now called Joint Task Force North, which is a subordinate element under U.S. Army North. So I'm very familiar with what this is all about. And he talked about the training and he listed some things, and they had a slide from the training that listed all things prohibited by posse comitatus. I looked at that slide. I looked at a number of these things that they put down as prohibited. And to use a very lawyerly phrase, I would have put the phrase depends after about half of them. It was a little overarching. Somewhere they had probably ran that by a judge advocate who may not have fully understood what law enforcement duties were. And they put a lot of things in there that really needed the modifier of it depends afterwards on what they're doing. As I've said on the air many times, that it certainly, like with some things, I said, look, if the ICE agent was to tell that guardsman, that federalized guardsman, go chase down that guy because he might be an illegal alien, the guardsman's right answer is, no, sir, I can't do that. That's a violation of posse comitatus. All right. However, if that person had gone up and attacked that ICE agent, thrown a brick at him or done something like that, I think that guardsman would have been well within his rights to basically take that guy down, to use whatever level of force necessary to stop the threat, the physical threat to law enforcement. I think that I'm not talking verbal. I mean, if you yell at him, you know, free speech and stuff, but I think that would have been perfectly, and he could have detained him until such time as someone from law enforcement could arrest him and do that law enforcement function. That is a very different thing. That's a very different function. And I looked at that training, and the training did not really make that very clear. And I think the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals could end up reversing this, because 2 months ago, when Judge Breyer had an order that was ruling President Trump's deployment of National Guard troops was illegal. And, you know, as far as enabling the troops to remain assisting with immigration raids or immigration enforcement in Los Angeles, the Ninth Circuit Court threw that out there and reversed that decision, right? And the ruling literally landed within hours of basically blocking that from happening. But I thought that was interesting. Now, there's two judges on that court that were appointed by President Trump. One was appointed, I believe, by President Biden. And so two of the three judges are Trump appointees. My take is that Judge Breyer, I thought he brought up some very good points in his decision and his opinion, but I think he overreached in certain areas. I thought he brought up some very good points, though. I think training matters. If that's how you train the troops, if that's what you're telling them, this is what it is, that has importance, you know, especially when you're talking about very important things like this. I would also say this. This is something I noticed over the years, particularly since 9/11. You would have training that was going out that was being done by subject matter experts. And then that training over time, as various organizations, public organizations, whether it was state, county, city, federal, whatever, they look at this stuff, they go, oh, we should do that. And they would step in. And instead of a subject matter expert, you'd have what I call a duty expert, which is they may not know it that well, but they are assigned to teach that training. When you do that, you lower the quality, you lower the level of training. And in this case, you also ended up with a situation where I think they were getting training that wasn't entirely correct, that wasn't accurate, and it came back and it bit them in a federal court when the judge is trying to figure out, what were you saying? What were you telling these guys? Were you telling them something? And he rested a good part of his opinion based on what was in those slides and what was being said by that instructor. And I think that was something where they need to take a hard look at training. Some of these practices of just grabbing somebody and saying, well, you served at one time in uniform, whether it's a police uniform, fire uniform, military uniform, whatever. So just go in and do this stuff. You take a certain amount of risk. There's a certain liability that goes with that. All right. So that's my take, is that that was something that I thought was worth mentioning. I think it's something they need to look at. They need to fix. I also think, and I said this many times on the air, that there's another piece of law they should have been looking at, which was the U.S. Economy Act. And the U.S. Economy Act was of the two pieces of law when I was doing, you know, defense support for civil authorities in uniform. The two pieces of law we looked at was one, Posse Comitatus, and the other was the U.S. Economy Act. And the U.S. Economy Act was the fiscal truth teller, if you will, which is a very short piece of law from 1932, goes back a couple of years, which basically means you have to get the most economical source of goods and services to perform whatever it is that you're trying to purchase or procure on behalf of the government. All right. And it's the concept that underlies things like competitive bidding. You know, that you go out there and you get competitive bids for government contracts, so you get the, you know, so you're not wasting or squandering taxpayer dollars. You're not engaged in stuff that could be seen as corrupt or conflicts of interest, things like that. So there's a lot of reasons why that is out there. There's a lot of reasons why that's there. And the U.S. Economy Act would have probably said, you got to get these troops out of here because they're the most expensive way to provide security for those personnel. You could have probably gone out and hired private security a heck of a lot cheaper, or done some sort of mutual aid thing or something like that. Or I don't know if they had the capability to do that, but I think there's a lot of different ways that they could have done that over time that would have been much more cost effective than what they were doing, than using troops. Because I could tell you, almost every time, using a military unit to perform these things was one of the most expensive ways you could possibly do it. They didn't do that. But I think that's because California was a plaintiff. California has a problem with the U.S. Economy Act. They've got a slew of state agencies that are federally designated, federally compensated, federally empowered to administrate federal funds, centrally receive federal funds, dispersals federal funds on behalf of the federal agencies that are responsible for those federal funds and those federal programs and federally sponsored programs. They get this delegated piece of authority, but they have for about a decade turned around, and what they cited went back over 15 years, basically saying, yeah, we get this, but when we get the money, we're not under obligation to follow all those federal regulations and guidelines. And I think that's why they avoided putting the U.S. Economy Act, that other of the two pieces of law that guided this stuff, they avoided putting that in there because I think they were afraid of bringing any attention to that particular piece of law. Because in that one, that's where I do believe that the federal government, the Trump administration, could come down heavily on the state of California. Trump administration has already said that they want to cut off funds to the state of California. And I think if they looked at that, that would give them something they would cite in whatever they're doing, because that's something California did. I haven't seen any other states. If they are, I just don't know about it, that have done something like that. But California did do something like that, and it is the thing they operate under. And that's why I think they avoided putting that whole thing in there, was because they just didn't want to put a lot of sunshine on that particular piece of law. Although I felt in this case, that piece of law probably was a very appropriate thing that they could have cited. And that could have been used to say, look, they brought him in on an exigent case and you have to get him out of there because they cost too much money and there's more economic sources of those services that could be brought in for elsewhere. But they didn't do that. And I think that's one of those things, but I think that's an Achilles heel for Attorney General Rob Bonta and of California, and for Governor Gavin Newsom, because if they bring that up, that little piece of law could be twisted to the other direction and really cause some serious problems for them potentially losing maybe not all $170 billion that comes to the state, but they could lose a lot, you know, maybe most of it, maybe almost all of it. I don't know. They would have to go back and fix that. Thanks for listening to Strap. Please visit strappodcast.com. Go to my YouTube channel, Hal Kiempfer TV. And I really appreciate you taking time to listen to this. I know it sounds like an arcane subject. You know, I'm quoting laws from 1807, 1878, and 1932, but it has all suddenly come into into play today. And it is very much part of our lexicon and the political discourse of what's happening that affects how the military works with civil authorities on a variety of things. By the way, this won't get any smaller because we've designated a bunch of drug cartels as terrorist groups. That's changed the rules of engagement. That has changed the legal status of those groups. And there will be more on this to discuss. Anyway, thanks for listening.